Blair Palmer, and welcome to the Punks in Suits podcast, bringing the leadership thinking, beliefs, philosophies, and practices behind punky, startup-y, next-stage businesses to you, even if your company's not quite there yet. Hello, and welcome to episode 9 of the Punks in Suits podcast. At this moment, after 8 weeks of podcasting, we're at nearly 500 downloads. To say that this has surpassed my expectations is a massive understatement. The reason I wanted to do this podcast was because my book is taking so long to write that I felt I wanted to get some of the concepts and resources out there in the world more quickly. It's also been a chance for me to test those ideas out and see if anyone in the world is interested. And it does seem that you, at least, are. So thank you so much. This week, I've got another interview for you. Sally McCutcheon is one of only 2 accredited Holacracy facilitators in the UK. In this conversation, she discussed some of the mechanics of Holacracy, and we get into an idea that she and I talked about privately a few weeks ago, the idea of cultural laws, beliefs and assumptions, ways of living that are so deeply embedded in our subconscious that we feel we'll be arrested and sent to jail if we break them.
I feel like I'm doing something wrong. I feel like I'm like breaking some kind of law, or that someone is going to tell me, like tell me off or fine me or put me in prison for doing something, like something, am I doing something illegal? Or I feel like I need to go someone at the very top, like I need to go to the Prime Minister. Theresa May, like, please, like, I need you to look at what I'm doing and just tell me that it's all above board.
We started our conversation before I hit the record button, discussing the fluttering of nerves that always happens as soon as that red flashing light starts going. It's the same flutter of nerves you get when you have to give a presentation or speak out in a meeting or just tell your friends something that you feel vulnerable about. I reassured Sally by telling her that it's only you, the listener, her and me in this conversation, which explains her hoot of laughter early on in our conversation. Let's go over to that now.
Sally, it's so good to talk to you.
You too.
Maybe you can tell our millions of listeners.
Oh.
the one person listening in their car on the way to work this morning. A bit about yourself, because you run your own business now, but you do come from a traditional corporate background. So tell me a bit about that and what happened.
What happened? What did happen? I'm still asking myself. So my background, well, I've always had a very strong passion for business since the age of 5 years old. I set up my first business in my parents' living room, gathering bits and bobs from around the house and trying to sell them from a little stool that I'd created in the living room. So business has always been a passion of mine, as has travel. And when I came out of uni, I travelled, did quite a bit of voluntary work and travelled quite a bit and worked as a holiday rep as well. So sort of living in glamorous places around the world, which was very exciting. And when I eventually kind of settled down, came back to the UK, sort of scratched my head a bit and thought about what I wanted to do. And it made perfect sense to me to combine my love of travel and of business and to go into the travel industry. That's what I did. Went in at entry level, was selling travel as a travel consultant. But I had such a strong passion for leadership and sort of started progressing up the corporate ladder fairly quickly. And absolutely loved my career, had an amazing time, learned an extraordinary amount, travelled the world, earned a lot of money. And it was all very exciting. And what I found in terms of my sort of own leadership style, I found that I was intuitively doing things a little bit differently and really, really wanting to be as authentic as I could. And I realized as well that I was, you know, in looking for people around me, that I was promoting authenticity was one of the things that I really honed into and really looked for. And I really was sort of quite passionate about giving space for everyone to shine, for everyone to be the best that they wish to be in their roles. And I got some really extraordinary results from doing that. And as time went on, I just realized that that was something that I really wanted to pursue. My heart was telling me in a big way that there was a new path for me to walk down. And it was an enormous decision to leave that career. It gave me at least 6 months of sleepless nights. but in the end, it was just the right thing to do. I didn't know exactly what I was going to do when I left. But what I did know is that it was the right thing to just walk down a new road and see what was there. And so I started exploring what I call humanness at work, started just getting out to conferences and networking and meeting all sorts of different kinds of people. I started interviewing conscious leaders around the world, which I absolutely loved. It was a really exciting time. I created a project called the Human Leaders, delivered a few workshops on humanness at work. And through all that research, I discovered Holacracy. And that was a funny thing. I wasn't necessarily looking for it. It found me and sort of one of those like, whoosh, like, right, okay, this is it. I'm in Holacracy now, and absolutely loved it. So for the past sort of 18 months or so, I've been a Holacracy practitioner, and I'm now a certified facilitator as well, one of two in the UK. And that's that, really. Here I am.
So this seems massive to me that you would leave the safety of corporate life to set up your own business without massive clarity about what it was that you wanted to do, or, you know, a kind of business model or anything. And a lot of people wouldn't have done it that way. A lot of people would either have stayed in corporate and kind of done some bits and pieces. And that's how I transitioned out of corporate life. Is that I carried on with my job, and in my free time, I trained as a coach and I had a few coaching clients. And then it got to the point where I thought, right, I need to choose. Other people wait for redundancy, so they've got a little bit of a financial cushion. Other people have real clarity about what it is they want to create, and they will, and they're leaving their work because they need to get started with it. But I don't think I've met that many people that just have a sense that they need to move on and then actually do. What do you think it was about you or about your circumstances that gave you the impetus or the confidence to make that decision?
I don't really know if I have the answer to that question. I mean, I was fortunate enough that I did have a financial buffer. And I think one of the triggers was sort of sitting down and looking at my finances one day and going, actually, I've got enough here to sort of keep me safe, if you like, for, well, it was about 2 years, actually. And when I looked at that and I was like, well, what's stopping me then? What's stopping me? And I mean, in the end, for the months and months of sort of thinking about it and sort of dreaming about it and being really scared about it and having a lot of uncertainty as to whether I'd actually kind of pull the trigger or not, the actual moment was really impulsive of sort of waking up one morning and going, I need to just start this ball rolling. And I had a 3 month notice period to work out. So, you know, it's nothing happened overnight, but it was something that I couldn't ignore. That's as much as I can say about it. I think it was that powerful that I just, in the end, had no choice.
I'm interested because we're going to talk about Holacracy and about what you've been doing since and your kind of ideas about the future of how business might look in the future. I'm just wondering about companies like the company that you worked for and losing talent like you. And there are lots of people who decide that corporate life isn't for them and they go and start their own thing. And some of them are people who've been setting up a little shop in their parents' living room since they were five. Other people are people who don't particularly want to run their own business, don't particularly, never really dreamt of that, but it's the only way that they can see to work in a way that enables them to stay sane, really, to do something that where they can make a difference and where they can make their own rules about how they live. Was there a bit of that? Was there a bit of, I can't completely be myself here, as well as I'd really like to go and do my own thing?
Yeah, 100%. 100%. It was just a sort of a feeling that I didn't quite fit, which I think some people would be really surprised to hear, because I think I did a really good job of looking like I did fit, appearing like I did fit. But yeah, there was a definite, a sort of a real need to sort of give myself the permission to be exactly who I needed to be, and not have to sort of sacrifice bits of who I am in order to fit in. Very much so.
So talk to me a bit about Holacracy, because that was the thing that you had no idea really that it existed, I suppose, when you left your job.
None at all.
And then it drew you in. And now, as you say, you're one of only two accredited Holacracy facilitators in the UK. Mm-hmm. What was it about Holacracy that appealed to you so much?
That's a really good question, because again, it was a really sort of just heartfelt yes, like this is something different, it's something new, and it's hard to say, it's hard to say exactly, you know, what it was. It was such a sort of momentous wow, like this is different. So there's a great quote that I found the other day, and it says, "The electric light did not come from the continuous improvement of candles." And I think I really sort of felt this idea when I started exploring Holacracy, that it was something completely different. It wasn't the continuous development of the candle. It wasn't just a tweak on what we've already got. It was something completely different. And that in itself really excited me, I think, before I even knew about the nuts and bolts of what Holacracy was. So just the process of the meetings, one of the most powerful things about that is that everyone truly gets a place to be heard. And that's something that is so often missing in organisations today. And I think what Holacracy really did for me is when I left corporate life, part of the appeal of working for myself was having the control of how things were organized and how things were done. And I thought that's what I needed. And I thought it had to be my own business to achieve that. But in Holacracy, I found a system that actually meant my sort of big realization was, oh no, actually, it doesn't have to be my own business here. I don't have to be the one in control. This is a system that means I could join a different organization here, because I've got so much trust of the processes of Holacracy, and it means that I can still collaborate, I can still work with people, but it just is completely different to the hierarchy that I'm used to.
So this goes back to the question I asked you before about your corporate job, that for so many people, the system isn't working for them, and the only alternative they can see is to go it alone. But they would want to stay in a company. They like being in a company. They like working with other people, but the system makes it difficult. So are you saying that with Holacracy, it would be, if more companies were holocratic, maybe fewer people would feel the need to leave and to go off and start their own thing?
Well, I don't think I want to give that guarantee. But certainly for me, it's a vast improvement. It's the difference between the candle and the light bulb in terms of having an organization where everyone can be heard, tensions can be resolved, everyone becomes a unique sensor to what's going on in the organization. And with that comes a real unlocking of potential and possibilities that's really exciting. And I think that's what can frustrate a lot of people in many companies is just a sort of status quo and just feeling frustrated that they've either been told that change is going to happen or that something's going to be different or that they see a way that things can be improved, but there's just no space for that to actually happen because of the bottleneck of the hierarchy or a lack of communication. Egos obviously come into play. You know, there's so many things that can stop what actually needs to be happening. from happening in an organization? Well, that, I mean, there's two big things that I often talk about that I've really learned since I left corporate life. And the one is that inner work for leaders is the most important thing that we need to do in business today. And the other thing is that the way that we typically organize is a direct barrier to us doing what we are trying to do. So yes, it's not a silver bullet cure. But for me, holacracy is a massive step towards that.
So for those people listening that don't know about holacracy, and I've actually interviewed quite a lot of people about holacracy, and it may sound to people listening that I think it's the only way, and I don't. I think that there are lots of different options for organizing people, but there are some things about, including the current way of organizing people. I'm not anti-hierarchy per se, although I do feel that, as you do, that there are built into the system are barriers to getting stuff done, that if you were looser about the hierarchy and that sort of seniority game that gets played, it would be much easier to work in organizations. So that's kind of where I come from. But still, holacracy is probably the most established alternative to hierarchy. So maybe you could explain in just, I don't know, can you do it in a couple of minutes? What holacracy is?
It's very difficult.
Because it is a little complicated.
Yeah, give me about 2 hours and I can really talk.
Okay, settle down, Fred. This is going to be a long one.
So a couple of minutes. So holacracy is a method of self-organising.
It's a complete alternative to the sort of traditional linear hierarchy that we're used to in organisations. That's not to say that there is no hierarchy. There is structure and there is a hierarchy, but it becomes a hierarchy of purpose rather than of people. So really the purpose becomes the North Star of your organisation, and really becomes the sort of foundation for all your decision making and focus. And a holacracy organisation is structured into circles. It comes from the idea of holons, which you see in nature. A holon is a whole cell or entity that has full autonomy to do the task at hand. So each circle within a holacracy has full autonomy to get on and do its job. And then within each circle you have roles, and people might energize a number of different roles. So it's very different to the normal job titles that you often get when you get a new job. This is your job title, this is what you do. Within a holacracy you might energize 10, 15, sometimes up to 20 different roles in an organization. And again, a role, in exactly the same way as circle, it's a whole on, it's a whole, and again it has autonomy to energize and fill its purpose in the best way that you as the role holder see fit to. So power is really distributed because of this shift of autonomy. Power is shifted and distributed throughout the organization, and every role holder within the organization becomes a unique sensor to what is going on. More importantly, there are processes in place that if you do sense an opportunity, in holacracy it's called a tension, which is a gap between what is and what could be. And at anywhere in the organisation you have this sensor, and any tension can be processed into meaningful change, whether it's that's at the in this circle, in this circle, at the top, bottom, wherever it is in the organization. And when all of that comes together, it really harnesses the collective intelligence within your organization, really untaps a lot of potential, and really makes your organization more agile, more fluid, much more responsive to what is actually going on, because you remove a lot of those bottlenecks, the bottlenecks of communication, of silos, of decision making, and power being held at the top, the traditional top of the organisation. So it's a powerful new way of organising.
So I really love the sound of it. When I first heard about it, I just thought, gosh, I hope my daughter grows up in a world where she can operate in that way. One of the things that I really liked was that as you said, the roles aren't job titles. And you will be energizing multiple roles at any one time, won't you? So you're not just, I don't know, I'm trying to think of a, you're not just responsible for email marketing. You might be responsible for email marketing and community building and PR. And because all of those things suit your skill set and they all kind of overlap, and you may adapt those roles over time as well, shed them or absorb more or distribute them in another way. That's right, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of the things that I love about Holacracy is this fluidity to work in roles and energize roles that best suit your skills and your development. And that could be in so many different aspects of the organization that you've not necessarily been able to or been allowed to work in before. That, of course, brings a whole set of challenges to the organisation. How do you compensate when there's that sort of fluidity? And so this really speaks to the idea of the candle and the light bulb. You know, what you're doing when you're implementing Holacracy is really quite a big shift. You will find yourself having to look at also, you know, how you do a number of different things that you might have taken for granted. And compensation is one of those. But there are examples around the world. Zappos is the most documented one. Washington Tech in the States is a great example. And there's a number of organizations in the Netherlands, Austria as well, that are really coming up with creative and quite exciting ways of doing things within their businesses that really support the idea that when you show up at work, you can show up as your whole self. You can show up energizing roles that suit your skills and experience, your learning, your desire for your opportunities within that organization, and therefore unlocking all the potential, not just at the top, you know, throughout the whole organization. You're just making these little dial turns that when they all come together can have an enormous impact.
I'm wondering, you mentioned about inner work, and I'm wondering about what people have to let go of in order for this system to work, because in a traditional hierarchy, we've been almost indoctrinated to look after our career development and to work our way up and to climb the ladder and all this kind of thing. And there's huge reward, not just financial reward or even sort of status kind of reward, but personal reward, maybe ego, but maybe something more meaningful about getting to a certain position in an organization. And I wonder if what some people worry about in a more self-managed, self-organized system or a holacracy is where they're going to get that from. We're all going to be, and I know this isn't how it works, but I can sense the discomfort around this. We're all going to be equal. You know, I've got 50 years of experience or 30 years of experience, and this little kid's coming in with 2 years of experience. What's to differentiate us?
Well, that's a big question. I mean, because are we not all equal anyway, actually, when we simmer it down? But yes, I understand your point. You know, within an organisation, how do you do that? And I think, you know, it's one of the big shifts. If you imagine, though, I'm sure this may well resonate to a fair few of your listeners, that idea that you get to a certain, you know, let's say you're sort of at ground level within an organization, doing the job, doing the work, and there's a high chance that you might love doing that. And the flip side to sort of wanting to progress for the status, for the position, for the money, whatever it is that actually a lot of people don't want to progress up the management ladder. Sometimes that actually takes us away from what we love to do. And, you know, imagine for a minute if you had the opportunity to forget about the money or the status or the position within the organization. Imagine that all of that's been taken care of. How that's been taken care of? Well, that's something that creative, that organizations are leaning into at the moment and exploring. That's at the very edges of what we're doing here. But imagine if you were able to achieve your sort of wildest dreams in terms of, you know, recognition and what you were able to give back just by doing a job that you love to do. And not worrying about having to progress up a corporate ladder
you know, if there was a way of earning more or getting the recognition or just being the best that you could be through the job that you want to do. I'm not saying it's easy, and I'm not saying that that I have all the answers in terms of how to achieve that. But for me, what Holacracy does is it's an opportunity. It's an invitation to explore a completely alternative way of doing things. And if you can let go of some of the constraints, some of the cultural laws, we were talking about that the other day, then, you know, if you can free your mind from that, then I think there's some quite exciting possibilities.
I wonder if it is quite liberating, that idea of being able to let go of all of that. And when I think about people that I work with that are in very senior positions in quite conventionally structured organizations, and some of them really love the role that they have. They really love the people bit of the role, and they have a real gift for that. And others, it does seem to be a kind of frustration that they can't get on with their, inverted commas, real work because of people stuff that they're dealing with. So for them, if they could let go of the ego attachment to the status, while still acknowledging that their vast experience has value to the organization, which is greater than someone who's been doing it for 2 years, potentially, because just because you've got 30 years of experience doesn't actually mean you've got more value, but let's assume just for now it does, then that might be really liberating for those people. What about the people who really love the people management? What is there for them in Holacracy?
I think that's probably a question that needs breaking down and around what is people management, because there would still be an opportunity to train people. You know, people may still need training and development support, peer-to-peer support, personal development, self-awareness, all that, you know, that side of things. What is removed within a Holacracy organisation is the telling someone what to do or how to do it. So that's what there is no longer space for, because each individual has full autonomy to energize their roles how they best see fit. But that then frees up for, you know, generating of new ideas, new concepts, new product lines, new means to market, you know, new technologies. There is space for so much more possibility when you take out some of the bits of people management that are very time consuming but aren't necessarily benefiting the organization once you make that shift to giving everyone that full autonomy.
I'm thinking about some of the stuff that managers have to get up to in terms of the yearly talent assessment process, where they go through everyone in the organization, and senior teams will spend a couple of days a year together going through every single person in their organization and deciding, are they at the right grade? Do we need to change their grade? And these conversations, I mean, they are fascinating to sit in on, but also make me wonder, is this the only time of the year that we're having conversations about what someone's contribution is? And actually, although I'm saying it's 2 days, that's pretty quick, given that, you know, some of these teams are talking about 100, 200, 300 people, and they're having to identify within a 2-day period. So that small amount of attention that goes into that, which is hugely frustrating, quite boring, not anywhere near enough, once a year, in the Holacracy, that doesn't exist, that job, right? That's 3 days for 8 people that is taken away.
I guess the reason I'm pausing a little bit is just to think through, you know, what replaces that. And there's no sort of predefined answer as to what replaces that. It's up to each organisation and each circle, really, each holon, to manage that process as they see fit. But yeah, you're absolutely right. That process is more or less redundant. And it is really sort of shifted into the ownership of each holon, each circle within the organization to do that how it's best needed.
Do you think we're ready as a society for this? Because we're really still very attached to our whole education system, our whole culture is still very attached to telling people what to do, and the command and control model is not talked about in the sense that people are trying to move away from command and control, but there's still plenty of it goes on, not just at work, but in our world, people waiting to be told what to do next. Do you think we're ready?
I think we are ready. I think the recipe, I mean, if you look from an evolution perspective, big shifts and big changes generally come when there is some kind of level of pain or crisis, and when there is a vision of a new way, a different way, a better way of doing things. I think we're at early days of this shift, but I think what most people will be able to identify with is the pain of the current system, the crisis that, you know, you can maybe see in our political system, in our educational system, as well as in our working system. So I think that that sort of crisis point is being felt. And in terms of the better way, that, you know, okay, what is the something else? What is the different way? I think that is being birthed at the moment. That is emerging right now. So are we ready? Yes, I think we are ready. Is this going to happen overnight? No, it's definitely not going to happen overnight. But I think from an evolutional perspective, everything is there for quite a big shift to happen.
Embarking on this journey around holacracy has been a developmental journey for you as well, hasn't it?
Why, yeah, has it?
What's some of the stuff that's come up for you on this adventure?
Do you know, Blair, I knew it wasn't going to be easy when I left corporate life. You know, I knew setting up my own business wouldn't be easy. I consider myself a realist, but my goodness, I didn't see this coming in terms of the extent. And you're absolutely right in saying that the bit that I didn't see coming and the bit that's been the most challenging is the personal development side. And the learning and the growing that I've had to go through. Yeah.
And what form has that taken? Personal development is such a massive term. In what ways have you been challenged? What beliefs have been challenged, or what systems you were operating by have been challenged by this?
Yeah, so I had a really lovely conversation with a friend a couple of weeks ago. And that morning, I'd had this realization that there was this sort of really niggling kind of seed of a thought that was so kind of deeply set, it was sort of almost subconscious. I wasn't fully aware of it. And that morning I just became aware of it. And it was a great opportunity to be able to explore it. And I said to her, I feel like I'm doing something wrong. I feel like I'm like breaking some kind of law, or that someone is going to tell me, like tell me off, or fine me, or put me in prison for doing something. Like, something, am I doing something illegal? Or is it my, you know, are my accounts right? Have I done everything I need to do for the legal structure of my organization? And I said, I feel like I just want to go to someone, like, you know, in corporate life, I had a boss who would, you know, who would sort of largely make me feel quite comfortable that I, you know, that I was doing okay. And when you're self-employed, you don't necessarily have that. And I was like, I feel like I need to go someone at the very top, like I need to go to the Prime Minister. Theresa May, like, please, like, I need you to look at what I'm doing and just tell me that it's all above board. And then it's okay. And then I kind of just thought about it. And I was like, well, hang on a minute. You know, come on, Sally, really, you know, you've done your year-end accounts, an accountant, a professional accountant has checked them over, you've got business insurance, it's the, you know, everything is above board here. Well, like, are you really worried that you're breaking the law? And that was when I realized, actually, there's a whole set of other laws that I now identify as cultural laws that I feel like I've been breaking. You know, the law of going into an office 9 till 6, Monday to Friday. You know, the law of doing battle with the rush hour on the London Underground every morning and every evening. The law of being employed. Like, this is, you know, it's not necessarily true for everybody, but, you know, my cultural laws are that is what you do. It's what my family have always done, my friends, it's sort of my, you know, my immediate society, that's what I see. And it's what I've always done. I've had a job, I've gone into work, I've commuted in the rush hour, I've worked really long hours, you know, and then you don't work at the weekend, and, you know, you take holidays, and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And I realized the thing that I was actually acknowledging was this fear of, oh, I'm doing something different. I'm working from home. I'm going out for a walk in the middle of the day, you know, if it's a nice sunny day and I want to get some fresh air, you know, and maybe that does mean that I work till 10 o'clock in the evening, one evening, or I work on a Saturday morning instead. You know, it's just this kind of fluidity and ease of life. You know, it's a real pleasure, but actually it caused me a whole heap of pain because I was so scared that it was something that I wasn't supposed to be doing.
I remember going to post a letter when I must have been in business for maybe a year, something like that. Maybe less, maybe just a few months. And I had to take it to the post office. There was a post office on my street. I lived in London at the time. And I was kind of doing the half run, half walk up the street with this letter in my hand to go to the post office because I was away from my desk and I thought, I've got to get to the post office really quick and get back to my desk.
Yes.
And then I sort of stopped in the middle of the street. I'm like, who is waiting back at my desk to tell me that I've taken too long to post this letter? Nobody. I am the boss. I'm the boss. Yeah. I'm a really nice boss. I'm not going to have a go at myself for taking too long to post a letter.
Except so you probably are having a go at yourself.
What's really having a go at myself for taking too long to post a letter? So I just slowed right down and I took my time to go and post a letter and I wandered back to... Now, still, I'm 16 years into this now and I still have that. I still have the, I didn't arrive at the office until 9:15 this morning. Mm. You know, somebody somewhere is going to judge me for that. Or some days I don't go to the office at all. In fact, a lot of days I don't come to the office at all. So it's so deeply embedded in our DNA. And I suppose, so I've been working now for about 25 years. And then I had my school, my education before that, and it was all embedded in that. It's all around us in our society. It's everything you hear about work and everything that you read about work. It's reinforced in that. And then it's 250 years of industrial age wiring that is so normal that we don't even question.
Yeah.
Anyway,
and they're so powerful. And thank you for saying all of that because it makes me feel quite a lot better at how strongly I'm feeling them. You know, I sort of framed it as, well, this is my reality, but framing it as actually, well, it's, you know, however many years of my own education and working life, but then, you know, the additional 250 odd years of industrial revolution. And yeah, it is the way things are, but it's not necessarily the way things have to be.
So what's possible then if you break those laws, or if you just see them for what they are, which is they don't even really exist in any true sense? What's possible for us, but also what's possible for you, do you think?
What it really comes down to is living my life as my heart desires, you know, in the most whole way that I can. And, you know, having this niggling feeling, even when I was working in a corporate organization, having this niggling feeling like this can't be it. This can't be all there is to life. You know, I had a really exciting career path ahead of me. I could have been there another 10, 20, 30 years until I retired. And it would have been an amazing career, really exciting. But it felt a bit predictable and it felt like I wouldn't reach my true potential by doing that. So for me, the possibilities when you do look at these cultural laws and you really, and you sort of, you stick with them, you really name them, you call them out and you feel the fear, you really feel that absolute sort of gets you right in the middle of the night, heart palpitation level of fear that you are breaking these laws. When you sit with that and really look at it, what I do is then give myself a choice. I kind of say, okay, well, if this is really this scary, what else could I be doing? And I look at the alternative options And so far, what's happened is that I've always sort of come back to this path that I've chosen and just gone, no, this is the right one.
Do you think it's important? Because this is something that I'm challenged with continually, but I've started to think it's really important, actually, that if you're going to be someone who goes into organizations and helps them in one way or the other to think about things in a really different way, that you yourself must put yourself into situations where you confront what happens when you do that. Because inevitably, there is going to be some fear, concern, some of it very justified by clients when you question deeply held beliefs. And not that they're not necessary, those deeply held beliefs might be true, but the fact is that they're unexamined often. So when you ask people to examine those beliefs, to consider that something else might be possible, and then if they realize that something else might be just as real, to go in the direction that that then facilitates. If you haven't done that yourself, if you don't live life that way yourself, then it's very difficult to understand what they're resistant to. Something that I find challenging is slowing down. So I find it difficult to take my time. I'm hugely productive every day, and I never like to stop something halfway through it, and I get very frustrated if I'm forced to stop. So that's very difficult for me. For someone else, that's not going to be terribly difficult. And so that isn't challenging to them. Some of the things we're asking companies to think about is comfortable for us, as we've been thinking about it for many years, but it's not for them. And so unless we're challenging ourselves with something and kind of coming face to face with some sort of cultural law, it's hard for us to empathize with what clients are going through. Do you think that that is important and maybe one of the reasons that you're putting yourself in this situation all the time?
I don't know why I'm putting myself in this situation all the time. For me, I'm going to sound very selfish now, but I mean, for me, the reason I'm doing this is for me, first and foremost. The fact that it might help me support others to do so is sort of more of a happy byproduct, really. I think I recognise that without me living my life the way I wish the world to be, you know, I'm not being a leader. I'm not setting an example. I'm not being a leader. I'm not supporting the cause in any way. You know, the only way that we're going to get through these crises, you know, many different sort of varieties of crises that are happening in the world right now, is to start with ourselves.
For people in businesses that are more conventional, that are not looking at holacracy or any form of disrupting the hierarchy, what can they take away and apply? Are there bits of holacracy or even bits of your own development journey that you think can really make a difference, even if just a little group of people are adopting them?
If you are looking to just start viewing your organisation in a new way, having a look at the cultural laws that are in place within your organisation is a really interesting place to start. You know, within an organisation, if there is a culture, a way of doing things, 99% of people will fall in line with that and fit in line with that culture. And I think it's really interesting for leaders to be really honest about what that culture is. What are the benefits to it? What are the bonuses, the pluses, the things that this culture is bringing? But what might this culture be limiting? How might it be stopping someone in the organisation living out their true potential? You know, how might your culture be stopping someone from being heard or from doing a job role that they're actually really passionate about? And meetings is a great place to start. Meetings within organisations are riddled with insane amounts of cultural do's and don'ts. Yeah. And they differ in different teams, departments, organisations. You know, from whether you turn up to that meeting on time or not, you know, you sometimes get meetings where it's just culturally accepted to turn up late. You know, that is what happens. Even down to the snacks that you have in the meeting, who talks first, who cracks the jokes, that all of that stuff, they are cultural laws within the organisation. So just starting at, you know, to look at your meetings and how you might be able to shift the culture of your meetings and unlock some potential that you're not yet experiencing. And this is where I think Holacracy has some great lessons. The tactical meeting process starts off with a check-in round. That in itself can be a really powerful shift to your meeting culture. And then perhaps looking at how you can bring in a process that might sort of take out that slight people element so that people don't become the heart of your meeting, but the process does. So I think culture around meetings is absolutely fascinating and a really, really good place to start.
It's so interesting you say that, because I've always thought of meetings as the culture of your business magnified. So when I'm asked to come in and kind of observe what's going on in the organization, maybe give a bit of feedback about what I see, I really only want to sit in on some meetings, because that's when you get to see everything that happens concentrated. So as you say, how the hierarchy works, what the cultural laws of the organization are, what topics are discussed and what topics aren't, and approaches to all of that. And it tells me so much about what's going on in the rest of the organization that it's almost not necessary for me to see anything else. You've got some events coming up where people can get an idea about Holacracy and how it works in a bit more detail, not in 2 minutes, but a little bit longer. So tell us about those events and when and where they are.
Yeah, so the first one that's coming up, Monday, 12th of December, and that's in Oxford. It's a full day intro to Holacracy workshop. So it's a full day to really kind of deep dive into the concepts and the practices. We start off with a sort of presentation about the basics, and then we literally go into a live simulation of the tactical meeting process. In the afternoon, we do another live simulation of the governance meeting process as well. So you can really get down and dirty with it in quite a safe environment. But we are talking about sort of real business issues, and it's a real fake company. and you can role play and really Holacracy is such a shift. You need to experience it for yourself to really understand it. And people can react very differently. It can be really interesting to just observe how it feels to be in that quite structured meeting process. So it's a really great workshop. And then I'm also doing one in London next year as well. That's a half day. Very similar content. It's kind of like the difference between an espresso and a latte, really. So if you like your coffee with extra milk, then come along for the full day one. But for the espresso version, that's in London on Monday, the 13th of February.
And I'll be at the one on the 12th.
Yay!
Yes! Helping you out. So anyone who's coming to that, I will get to meet you there. And I'll be in learning mode as well, because, as I said, I'm fascinated by it. And it does seem to be the most advanced system so far in this area. But it's something that I still don't know very much about. So I'm really excited to find out more. Well, thank you so much for talking to me today, and it's been really, really enjoyable, and I feel like I just need to go out and post a letter or something and take my time.
It's a slow walk.
It's a really slow walk.
Thank you for your questions, challenging as ever, Blair.
Thank you.
Such a great conversation. I hope you enjoyed it too. I particularly enjoyed the idea of cultural laws and the visceral reaction we get when we feel that we're breaking them. If you'd like to know more about Sally's upcoming workshops, just go to Sally's website, thehumanleaders.com, or go to the Punks in Suits Facebook page, where I've put details of both events that Sally talked about. Next week, I'll be talking about where I get my inspiration, the books, podcasts, and concepts that have laid the foundation of my development. It might even give you a few ideas for your Christmas list. But for now, here's the lovely 9-year-old Ivy Palmer, who has a few questions for you to consider, having listened to my chat with Sally.
The idea of cultural laws may interest you. What cultural laws do you think you are breaking? And what cultural laws do you abide by without questioning whether they are right for you? What would happen if you broke them? And thank you again for listening to the Punks and Suits podcast today. We would still love to get more comments, so please go to iTunes straight away. Dash there fast as you can. And share your thoughts as it helps people find us. We also have a Punks and Suits Facebook page now. Plus, as ever, you can follow Mummy on Instagram and Twitter. Please tell all your cuddly friends.